Welcome to another edition of Geopolitics and Empire. Quick reminder to support this Rebel transmission. Best way to do that, become a paid subscriber on Substack. $5 a month or a measly $50 a year. You can also buy me a coffee, send reinforcements through DonorBox, or monthly through Subscribestar, since I'm banned on Patreon and PayPal. You can also purchase a consultation with me to talk about whatever you like: expatriation, geopolitics, or the meaning of life. Joining us is expert Bruce LaDuc, who invented artificial innovation, and he's got a lot of interesting things to say when it comes to artificial intelligence. Welcome to the podcast, Bruce.
Thank you.
We found each other on the socials recently, and maybe if you could tell us a bit about your background, whatever you want to tell us, and the arc of your work when it comes to AI and so forth.
So I started researching. Initially I went to school for advertising, believe it or not, and I was a graphic design major. And in that era, it's been since around the 80s, 90s that the creativity was a really big thing. People were really into it. Edward de Bono, lateral thinking, TRIZ methodology. A lot of the methods that people use today were originated back then. I started studying creativity and innovation and problem solving from the perspective of all disciplines. I would go to the library and pick up 20, 30 books and read them at night and evening. And I was a pretty fast reader. I could speed read and could get through a lot of material. So I went through everything related to creativity and innovation. And what I found was insidious amounts of overlap. There was, concepts that were, in one discipline were the same in another discipline, but they use different words. So when I got that all worked through, I started to use to develop a methodology, and I used that methodology to perfect it. And what it boils down to is things like scientific method, brainstorming, all the different creative methods, problem solving. All of that really collapses down into a single process that works with reasoning. Reasoning and artificial innovation are kind of like concentric rings. They overlap slightly. They're not independent processes. The left brain and the right brain work together in concert, and you can't really separate it out. What has happened in the world is they've tried to separate that out. And I can get into that in a minute. But after I discovered this, I tried to deliver it, and I found pretty quickly that they weren't interested in an innovation. They already had a path. It involved crypto. It involved what I believed was a control grid. It involved nanotech, and a lot of that was already worked out in the 80s and 90s. It really was born probably in the 80s and 90s, and then in the 2000s and up till now, they've worked it into a more mature solution. But I was hearing about cryptocurrency way back. I was in the rooms. Back then, they had email discussion groups, and they didn't have social media. And in those discussion groups, they were talking about cryptocurrency and had plans for it a long time ago. So I think all of that has been a preset plan. And when I tried to bring artificial innovation into that plan, it was rejected pretty sorely. I would really get yelled at basically by people, ran off. So I really just quit trying and started studying it from the perspective of my job. So I went out, got just a normal job, started to do the work and study this from that perspective. Also volunteered in outside of work in community organizations and studied it from that perspective. And I've been doing that since the 80s and have a very solid understanding of how kind of everything works together, what works, what doesn't work, what's happening today, what they say is happening versus what's really happening. I think I've learned a lot over the years about what's really going on.
Before getting to AI, there's a number of points you bring up that are fascinating. And, you know, to get your thought on when you say they, and it's hard for anyone to know, but I what you're saying kind of matches with my view as well, that a lot of this stuff comes from the deep recesses of the Pentagon, or we can point to ARPA, DARPA. You know, they created the internet, GPS, if you ask me, Facebook, seed funded Google, and you know, all this stuff. So it really wouldn't be a stretch to just extrapolate that many of the other tech that we're seeing and then even using has come from them, or if it hasn't come from them, they've purchased it and then incorporated it into their sort of military, industrial, technocratic system. And when you say they, who do you think they might be?
Yeah, I see the government as largely having funded most of this technology in the background. I agree with you with what you're saying on the funding. I know that, you know, like DARPA has always had open research programs and done a lot of research in AI and probably led a lot of research. But I think probably the click or the crowd is more in the educational system that's being funded by the government. The government's more in the background. The education system does most of the heavy lifting. And that was really where you had to get in to the in crowd, per se. And to me, it was a club. It was determined by who was funded. And most of that funding was government funding.
And you mentioned crypto as well. And it's funny because from the get-go, I have not changed my personal thesis. I know some people will disagree, but I've always viewed Bitcoin, I've called it a globalist Trojan horse, a way to whet people's appetites to bring us into this cashless society. And it's funny, people like Aaron Day, who I've interviewed on my other former radio program on TNT Radio, who's an entrepreneur, an investor and tech crypto expert, he just this week said maybe Bitcoin was a psyop the whole time. And it's just like, well, hello, McFly, you know, and yeah, great respect for Aaron Day and people like that. It's just seeming that, and the governments are now coming after exchanges, the off ramps, regulation is piling in, BlackRock is coming in with the ETFs and all that. I just kind of view that also, again, they came up with Bitcoin and crypto for their purposes. What are your thoughts on cryptocurrency?
So I think it was around 2002 that I think it was the National Science Foundation published a paper about MBIC, info cognitive merger. And that was, I think, the first mention of these kind of elements coming together. However, I think it had already been somewhat worked out well before 2002. That was just the published date of that paper. What it really means is that all of these elements, whether you're talking about nano, which is atomic size particles that are manufactured or put together by humans, you've got bio, which is a cell, a tiny particle, which would be the cell and the pieces of the cell, components of the cell. mRNA, RNA, DNA. And then in the info, you have, all of that piece of technology, which includes banking and money, cryptocurrency, all of that's info or bits, bytes, the smallest level there is bytes. And cognitive is cognitive science, which is how the mind and how thinking and the brain work. All of those things can exist independently, but I think that paper was sort of the first shot over the bow of all this stuff's going to at some point become one thing. And in my mind, you're exactly right that crypto was going to sort of pave the way for that movement towards centralized currency. CBDCs, central bank digital currencies, are already announced. I think 92% of countries have already said that they're going to implement them. I don't know if that would go over. There'll be rebellion, whether people will go for it. But that is absolutely centralized money. If that occurred, would Bitcoin go away, or would Bitcoin become a trading platform, more of a tokenization? I think what I believe it sort of lends itself toward is this tokenization of everything. So if you think of, you know, the body, the mind, the technology, and nanotech, which has created small things, that all being one thing, and everything tokenized, everything tracked, everything having data on it. I mean, there's no escape. Even, you know, like they have mind reading and all this, there's no way out of that digital matrix. And it's forming pretty quickly. I mean, if you think about where we're at right now, we're on the cusp of three or four of these major technologies being able to come together and create what I would call basically a digital prison. You have no recourse. If they don't like what you say, they take your, or they shut your money off. If they don't like who you are or what you stand for, they can literally attack you at the cellular level. They can attack you with frequencies and nanotech. So there's the potential there for harm. There's also the potential for hyper technology and the most astounding era that we've ever seen. And there's always two sides to the coin for technology. I've always been in the position that MBIC does not have to merge. Those things do not have to come together. I think a good example of a person that's sort of the prophet of MBIC, I would call it Charles Ostman. He's a really brilliant guy. I mean, absolutely brilliant. His site's Historian of the Future. But it basically starts with the premise that we're going to merge with technology as human beings. And in my mind, if humans merge with technology, they're cyborgs. They're not humans anymore. But there is a very large faction and a lot of the education system that is going down that path. And where that really leads is what I would call neo-feudalism, which is that, you know, we have the aristocracy, the techno-aristocracy, and then a few servants and a few technologists supporting that. And everyone else is quote unquote useless eaters.
Something you mentioned in your notes to me, and this is, again, this is what I'm banging on about for a long time. I view this sort of as the number one or number two threat facing all of us. You know, wars, again, we can escape from if tactical. I don't believe in the nuclear winter theory. So even if nukes are used, a lot of people will die, but we can still sort of rebuild and recover. But if they install this digital control system globally, there's absolutely no escape. In 2020, June of 2020, I interviewed renowned Jewish historian, one of my favorite interviews that I did, Edwin Black, and he calls this system the algorithm ghetto. Others call it the social credit system, cyber gulag, digital gulag, electronic concentration camp. There's so many names for this system. It's all the sci-fi dystopias put together. Brave New Worlds, Zamyatin Zvi, Orwell, so on and so forth. And I often am referring to this neo-feudalism. We're seeing them wipe out the middle class while simultaneously. So they're removing the middle class as they bring in this technocracy to then keep us from being able to rise up again and then create this two-tiered, basically, system. And you mentioned something interesting. With all this tech coming in, digital currencies, the economy's shifting, the old economic system is dying. And they're also bringing it down. And you talk about, well, two things, that a replacement economy is needed because of all of these changes. And I guess you say there can be two types. The one they're trying to bring in, you call a psychopathic version of the replacement economy. But so the point here is that you say that whatever the reason that we do need a new sort of economy with all this tech.
Yeah, I mean, there is absolutely no way. We've let the genie out of the bottle, right? It's already in flight. It is going somewhere. You have choices. And I think there is a faction, a clear faction, to bring this into the neo-feudalistic world, which to me is psychopathic. But if you think about, what's an alternative to that? Okay. I was just having lunch with somebody who's talking to me about STEM education and how science and technology has been this huge focus over the last few decades, and that, you know, everything's about technology. Everything's about getting these IT people skilled up. Well, we're starting to reach the pinnacle of that, right? And as you get to artificial superintelligence, or even just artificial reasoning, to where the machine can actually reason, which is not generative AI that cannot reason. If you get to that point, you kind of reach this place in society You have choices now on how you're going to set this up. And if you want to do it with everyone participating, it's going to swing away from technology, more toward the humanities, more toward entertainment, arts, more toward services, more toward tourism. And that's what we're trying to set up. I'm actually working on setting up an institute to set up a model for what that new economy might look like. We have kind of, I think, peaked in terms of technology education, and we are going to have to shift that over to a different type of economy if we're going to have actually a middle class. If we're going to have most of humanity participating, then it cannot be a technology economy. Now, I say that with a little bit of a caveat. So artificial innovation is very different from artificial intelligence. I always called what's happening today is kind of like a global half brain. They are working almost entirely on the left side of the brain. They are the Gen AI and those kind of models are all statistical models. They're not reasoning. So they haven't really perfected the left brain methodology yet. Although there's a couple people really close. They have not perfected that. But the right brain methodology, if you consider that you can automate innovation, okay, or automate creativity, you see a little bit of that with some of the work that they're doing with Gen AI and imagery or video. But if you could consider that as a knowledge machine, so you can improve an improvement of an improvement of an improvement. You can innovate to no end, to the end of your storage capacity. That creates a situation where I can ask a question and I can get an answer 12, 15 generations ahead. That's really what you would call the singularity, right? And if you look at a world that has a machine or set of machines like that, you could literally ask a question and then spend your life implementing something or building something that's so far beyond comprehension, that we really enter a hyper technology era. And I do believe that's coming. I believe that it's the social context it sits in that is critical. You know, it could be hyper technology for a few or hyper technology for all. It just depends on whether it's collectivism or individualism.
I had a guest on recently who wrote a fantastic book, German scientist, entrepreneur, Jobst Langrib. Shout out to him. He's probably going to be listening to this. And he said that AGI, what they sell us, the Elon Musks, these Ray Kurzweils and so forth, a lot of these transhumanists, AGI will become sentient, that Skynet will become self-aware. Jobs says that will never be possible, that right, for AI and as AI develops, there will be, as you mentioned, very good, perhaps narrow uses for it that can be used for good or for bad. But he says that he doesn't think AI will become sort of like a conscious or sentient. Do you have any thought on that?
Yeah, so to me, consciousness or sentience is around, so all of us are observers. We have an internal observer, and that observer is a light being. So you have light inside of you, a light being that's inside of you that is conscious. That is where consciousness emanates from. You can't mechanize that. You can't build it with a computer. You can create everything else, right? So when I talk about artificial reasoning, that's the machine being able to actually think, to be able to process, to be able to categorize and file and, you know, deal with information in its totality. When I talk about innovation on artificial innovation, it's the ability to create, the ability to build up from something that exists and make it take it to another generation and another generation and higher and higher. So if you talk about artificial superintelligence, it's a combination of those two things. It will not be conscious. I totally agree with that. It would have to have a spiritual aspect to it to become conscious. And to me, that is our internal light being observer. That's the conscious part of us. But it can look, act, function almost exactly like humans, only far superior. AGI is a term used to that the machine would be able to do relatively everything that a human does. I think ASI is going to just supersede that, and AGI is just kind of not going to happen. It's going to go straight to ASI. Once we get reasoning figured out, which I think some people are almost there, then if they understand that that's only a partial process and that without artificial innovation, it's not complete, then you have ASI and you don't, you know, AGI is out the window. It doesn't matter. It's super intelligent. It's smarter than you. But it doesn't. I think of it more as an order taker, like, tell me what the next or give me 15 generations of this problem and give me the solution and draw a diagram and help me build it. Well, then I can go and create or move it into a factory that's automated that can take these designs and build it. It doesn't look like the way, you know, the Terminator or the Singularity crowd, the way they position it, like it's going to come up and take over everybody. It's still a machine. It cannot feel. It cannot believe, because belief comes from that internal being, from that spiritual being. But I'll throw a caveat in, and that is that when you talk about technology, and it's starting to happen now, when it moves from, you know, Newtonian physics into quantum technology. And in my opinion, quantum is spiritual. What people are starting to understand is that technology, when you really start to dig into the root of it, it becomes a spiritual application. And they're starting to mess with that, which I don't think necessarily is a good thing to do unless your eyes are wide open. But the in my opinion, technology is like a circle. It starts out with, you know, rocks and stones and spears. It rolls up to information technology. Then it rolls into quantum technology, which is spiritual. And then you find out that it all comes back to the same place, which is that spiritual zone or that internal light being observer where that resides. It's really all one thing. And it wasn't what you thought. So I believe we're in a process of kind of making that circle. I think there's a lot of danger in it, but there's also a lot of opportunity in it. And it just depends on how mature as a society we are and how well we can handle this transition.
Yeah, what you said about spirituality, I think that's spot on. I think Jobst mentioned that and other people that I've seen. And, you know, he calls it something to the tune of neo-pagan pseudo-religion. People talk about magic, this trans-post-humanism. And again, there are different definitions here. There's technology, but what I think some of these Ray Kurzweil types, they've made it into sort of technology, into religion. And, you know, people have pointed out, if you took someone from like 500 years ago and you brought them today to the future and they saw all this stuff, they would see it as magic. Like what we're doing with the phone and the quick transport and what we're doing now, that would be magic literally for them. And you know, before getting back to AI for a second, you mentioned hyper technology, you know, this singularity. You know, what comes to mind is Matt Damon and Elysium. How far do you think they could realistically get? What would the world look like in sort of singularity-ish, you know, this hyper technology future?
I mean, my best guess, like, you know, it depends on what is allowed and what course we take. If you get into the whole human machine merger, you can start to see basically evolution of cyborgs, evolution of environments, you know, digital and natural environments. So when you could call it evolution or corruption, I would call it more corruption of environments. So there's a lot of potential to change everything. And to me, that sort of is this sort of paganistic religion of let's make humans better. Let's improve on it. Like I said, what those people find out that it's all a circle and you're coming back to the start, you're returning to go. You're not going to go into this, eternal life situation that you think you're building. I don't think that's how it'll work out. I do think though that if you talk about the machines and, you know, instantaneous travel, portals, time travel, time portals, anything is possible, because the more you get into quantum, you know, the more nothing has rules. And you start to see that, you know, you can affect one particle on one side of the earth and it affects a particle on the other side of the earth. That observation affects, the observation affects matter, that you actually are building that with your observation or with your internal observer. You're actually directing your world. So a lot of it, I think, is not going to be what people think it is. I think as we get deeper into quantum, we're going to find that it's not, the world doesn't look like we thought it was going to look. It's not Star Trek. It's not the way, the Mars colony. It's not like that. I do think, though, that it could have some just staggering things, like, you know, teleportation, quite possible, instantaneous travel. You know, some of the things you see in sci-fi are quite, almost anything that you've seen is possible, good and bad, I guess is the best way to say it.
And then to jump back to the AI, the state of AI today, I'm hearing different criticisms where some people are saying that a lot of the big tech, they're faking it just to increase their share numbers. And so the AI, that, you know, the ChatGPT stuff, all the LLMs, all this stuff, that it's really totally high. And that's, you know, historically, that's been the pattern with tech, the dot-com mm-hmm. bubble, all this sort of stuff. And so on the one hand, there's people saying that, like, what they're telling us AI can do right now is just, it's kind of a sham. But then there's some people saying, I've seen some clips saying that what they have in secret is very advanced, and they're sort of just seeding this stuff out to get us acclimated to it. What are your thoughts regarding that, as well as the current sort of state of AI as it's being rolled out to us?
Yeah, so large language models and LLM is really a statistics-based approach. It's kind of like saying, if you ask me, hey, you want to go to lunch? And I say, just a minute, let me do a probability analysis. And, you know, I have to figure this out. It takes a lot of energy. I gotta go get on a computer and plug in. So super high energy consumption, really difficult to... kind of like brute force thinking is the best way to think about it. It is not capable of a lot of the things that they're saying it can do. It does not reason. But I would say we are on the cusp, and I know people that are close. I kind of watch the landscape. There are people that are very close to artificial reasoning, which to me is an entirely different ballgame. That's when the machine can think the machine can do what they're promising today. It actually would be able to do that. And that becomes a different situation. So, for example, if I had an artificial reasoning system, I could ask that system, tell me the most efficient way to move from where I'm at to a fully automated company. It would give me a plan, spit it out, tell me exactly how to do it, exactly what software to use. You know, I could have everything I want. I still have to go do it, you know, unless robotics emerges to, you know, be able to go do it for me. At this point, I would still have to go do it. But once artificial reasoning hits, the landscape will radically change. And that's why it's so important to be thinking about what's going to happen to people when they all lose their jobs at the same time. What's going to happen to the economy, right? And so I think if you look at this landscape today, nobody cares about what happens when the jobs go away. None of these guys that are pushing Gen AI or AGI or anything that they think they have, none of them say, well, what's that going to do to society? And that tells me they're pretty much all psychopathic. They are not empathetic about what they're actually doing. They don't respect it. They don't care what it's going to cause. And that's a problem. So the fact that we're on the cusp of artificial reasoning, which would make it even more intense, and start to bring on this need for a new economy, and no one's talking about it, is a serious problem.
Yeah, I see. And I think there are different strains of elites. I was listening last night to a speech by Russian intellectual Andrei Furstov, and he actually mentioned you have like moderate globalists, and then you have like the full-on insane globalists, where the more moderate ones are like, you know, hey guys, chill out. Let's not like kill everybody, you know? And so I think what you're mentioning, you got some of these Ray Kurzweil types that maybe they're not outright, let's say, Malthusianists, but they just want to see what's on the other side, like the mad scientist, and they don't care about the damage that's going to happen. And then I think you have others that are, you know, like this old European sort of aristocratic Malthusians that are like, yes, let's do away with some of the population, and people will just inadvertently become impoverished and just slowly die that way, so on and so forth. And what about energy? You mentioned energy. I'm reading now, you know, we had this World Economic Forum meetings just in the past days, and there was discussion of energy, and you're seeing reported now that these data centers, you know, cloud computing, AI, the data center, all the stuff that's going to be needed now for AI, that they use immense amounts of water and energy, which we don't currently have. And so any thoughts on energy?
So, you know, well, like I said, if I use that example of going to lunch and having to do a probability analysis about to make that, that's not reasoning, right? Reasoning's simple. Reasoning's fast. We make that decision quick. It's low energy. You know, it's low energy because I don't have to plug in to talk to you, right? We have very low energy requirements in the human mind. So the process of reasoning, when it's really fully understood, will not require the level of energy that what we're doing today requires. These asks for, you know, trillions of dollars or billions of dollars because we've got to build all this infrastructure. Well, you're building infrastructure for the dinosaur of AI. If you wait a few years, we're going to have a low energy requirement replacement, which again is dangerous, very dangerous, but it is coming, and it isn't going to require the same level of energy that what we're doing today. That's a kind of like a brute force approach. The process of reasoning is elegant and very simple. It collapses almost every process we know, like scientific method, problem solving, innovation, genius, all these terms that we use to describe the mind. When you really fully understand logic, inference, when you really understand artificial reasoning or reasoning as a process, it's elegant, simple, low power requirement. So we're moving in quickly into a place where the training may be more difficult. You know, it takes a while to train a human, right? The way we train, I think you could circumvent some of that with the machine, but it definitely does not have the same requirements that Gen AI and the approaches we have today. It's going to be far, far, far less energy.
All right. What else is important for you? Sometimes I lose track of all these terms: artificial intelligence, artificial generative intelligence, AGI, as you mentioned, yeah. Artificial innovation, artificial reasoning, artificial super intelligence. What else is important for us to know?
One of the main things that I think it is probably the preeminent issue, which gets zero traction, is trust. The Edelman Trust Barometer is you can do a Google search and look that up, and it'll show you that most of our institutions today, government, business, religious institutions, are not trusted. That trust is at an all-time low. People are polarizing. So I think, you know, most people, if they had a choice, like 20% would live next to somebody that they disagree with. Stats like that. I mean, there's absolutely almost zero tolerance for one another, zero trust. And we're entering an age where, you know, trust is paramount. If you build a machine that can build a weapon that could destroy the world, you better trust it. Right. If you build a machine that can create a nano warfare, which we really have already done, you could, that's a serious problem. You've got to have a trust layer in there. And the trust is both on the machine side and the human side. The human has to be trusted in terms of their motives for society, and the machine has to be trusted in terms of its ability to deliver something without hallucinating or without error or without creating big problems.
Yes. And well, they talk about blockchain as being one solution for that. I had a guest on recently, and there's people talking about this now, create this sort of global blockchain, and kind of what you referenced earlier, what I'm afraid of. They want to put us all on the blockchain and tokenize, and I feel that's like a spider's web from which you'll never get out. But some people are arguing to get rid of privacy, to only have transparency and have blockchain, and that way that's going to have sort of like this universal immutable trust. You know, any thought on blockchain or
Yeah, well, I mean, that's a good example to work with. So let's say that we tokenize everything, your dog, your cat, the grass, your body, everything has been smart dusted and tokenized, and everything's in the blockchain. Well, what if the person that runs applications on that blockchain is untrusted? And now you got a serious problem because you're exposed, right? So trust has to be the layer. There has to be a layer of protection between the human and the system. It's kind of like, having permission to do a medical procedure, you know, requiring individual permission to do a medical procedure. But we have none of that with this technology. I mean, there's already nanotech in the wild. There's already nanotech. We've all been exposed to it. And I call it nano poisoning. Pretty much everyone's been nano poisoned with some level of smart dust. And, you know, I didn't give anybody permission to do that. How do I know I can trust the person that is doing that? How can they trust what I'm doing? You know, trust becomes the currency that allows us to move into this kind of a future without destroying ourselves. And right now, the level of trust we have for ourselves and for institutions, both, is at an all-time low. And our technology is moving into an all-time high, which is a very bad combination. That's not good. So we have to mature as a society, understand how to trust, where trust comes from, how to build it up, how to establish it. What we're doing in our institute, I'm working on an institute called Borden ASI Institute, is to actually build up trust from the ground level using volunteers. The thing about volunteers are they care. They wouldn't do it in their volunteer time if they didn't care about the community they live in, about the outcomes that they're going to have. So working with volunteers, you have a very different dynamic, and you can pretty much guarantee. Now, sometimes they're not trusted, but you can pretty much guarantee there's a very large volume of trust in a volunteer group. And when you work a network that way and build it out with volunteers, you can build a high trust, what we call high trust network. You can trust the people. You can trust what's going on. And if you put systems in and around that, you can trust the systems because everything is trusted. Now, that's just one approach, but trust is core, and absolutely nobody's talking about it. And that's the pivot on which we will survive or perish, succeed or fail. Trust is what we will pivot on.
So as you say, pivot, would you say we're sort of at a crossroads?
Yes.
Now when it comes to AI, I mean, you've got governments around the world. China's doing its stuff. You know, Putin in Russia said recently that if a nation doesn't dominate AI, it's going to be left behind. And you've got, of course, big tech then, which is more powerful than nations. Now we've entered right into an age of supranationalism. Basically, nation states don't exist. If you ask me, democracy does not exist anymore. We're living in technocracy, and scientific dictatorship, whatever you want to call it, because our politicians now are at the behest of these transnational corporations and interests, and the political financial elite. And they can, you know, I've had on Dr. Robert Epstein, who says, you know, big tech can sway the vote any way they like. So democracy does not matter anymore. And so I feel like we're at this crossroads and things are being developed, AIs, AGIs, all this other stuff. And so sort of your thoughts on you know, where we are and then how things might develop in the coming years, the road ahead.
Yeah, I mean, it is absolutely the edge of the ledge. And that ledge is artificial reasoning. Once we reach that point, once that's discovered and implemented, game on. We are leaning toward a bad model, in my opinion. We are leaning into a very untrusted world. You can enforce that, you know, Chinese version social credit system. Not a world I want to live in, but you can enforce trust, right? Here's the biggest danger. The biggest danger is that knowledge is not many, knowledge is one. The more powerful machines get, the smaller knowledge gets. If I learned anything with artificial innovation is, and you can apply that methodology to anything, that almost everything has been overcomplicated. Everything we know is not that hard. It's hard because we've used 20 terms to describe the same thing. We have overlapping definitions. We have all this confusion in our knowledge base, in our social knowledge base. Once artificial reasoning gets hold of that, it's going to bring it down into a cup. Okay, it's going to make it a lot simpler, a lot more straightforward, a lot more powerful. And there are a lot of ways you can go with that cup, right? I mean, there's the technocrats can take it and enslave people. We could create a cooperative, more individualist society, right? Where we are cooperating and trusting each other and building this up. And there's a lot of ways it could go. But the edge of the ledge is artificial reasoning, and we are there. So, you know, we are at a very critical time in human history. I don't know which way it'll go. I watch the tea leaves. I think there are people, like you said, there's different ranges. There's the psychopaths, clear psychopaths. So there are people that just lack empathy, that are people that are just left brain. There are people that are concerned about everything. And there are people that have high empathy. There are people that want this to go well. So I don't know how it's going to play. It is a war. You can think of it as a war because everybody's trying to get to the finish line. But when they get there, they're going to find out the world's going to shrink. Knowledge is going to shrink. And suddenly we're going to have the ability to explode it. And how you explode it or how you advance it depends on you and depends on these decisions we're talking about. How are we going to set up that society? How are these social structures going to be set up? We are on the cusp of having to make those decisions. The scary part to me is no one's talking about that part. No one. I mean, well, you know, a few, but it's not at all part of the narrative. No one is thinking this is going to do something to us. And it absolutely is. So that's the part that we have to change. We have to step that part up and catch it up with what's going on. Technology is not going to go away, but we absolutely have to have an understanding of what we can personally do. And I think there's a whole lot of power in grassroots networks, way more than people realize. A grassroots network can overtake all of this and change the way that everything works. But you know, you have to start it. You have to do it. You have to do the work. And that's the piece that I think we've got to step up to. We haven't done it yet.
Yeah, that is the good news. You mentioned when it comes to solutions and, but like you mentioned, alluded to earlier, I'm kind of with you. It's been kind of evident for people listening to me the past number of years that we are sort of on the road towards this dystopia, because you see, every day I'm reading now, in the UK, particularly this morning, I was reading, and people, listeners were commenting in the Geopolitics and Empire, Telegram channel where I curate the news daily. In the UK, many places are cashless now. You can't pay with cash. Governments are bringing in digital ID. I've seen some of these governments, in their own words, say that with these government digital ID systems, which will encompass all public and private services, everything in your life, your licenses, your passports, everything, that they can it's inclusive, but it's also exclusive. So they can close off life for you. And so that is dystopian. I just kind of, as you alluded to, I feel like we are on that road, which is extremely dangerous. And any thought, if we continue on that road, what people can do? You know, my instinct is just common sense stuff. Try to be more analog, living analog, maybe living outside of a city, having like a farm where that sort of digital control grid will have less of an impact or effect on you if you're sort of further off from it. Any thoughts there?
Yeah, I mean, once money, I mean, CBDCs that would not be possible. You know, you couldn't have a lemonade stand. You know, there's no cash. So you can't go, you can minimize your exposure to it. You know, like, for example, some people that don't, you know, they use a Faraday bag for their phone. They don't have Wi-Fi. They hardwire everything, you know, to minimize their exposure to 5G and frequencies. You can limit how much you are, how deep you are, but you cannot escape it if currency, which is not money, but if currency is, you know, the way that you trade is electronic, you don't have a choice. I mean, I kind of liken it to, imagine that you spent your whole life writing books, and you wrote 100 volumes of books, and they were all electronic. You know, and you store those on a cloud, and you don't know if you can trust that cloud, but you know you've done it for 70 years of writing, and you've got all this material out there, and you've never really asked yourself, can I trust the cloud? And one day you get ready to log in and somebody hit the delete key and your whole life is gone. And that's digital, right? If you don't have trust and it has control, it can delete you and you're gone, right? I mean, literally, it could even delete you in terms of nano warfare. It could delete you and take you out, you know, kill you. So trust, again, is what you have to have in this world. If we continue down a path where I believe a lot of these people are not trusted and they're in charge and they're in control, the only option is to organize your own human trust network and build up from the grassroots, from the ground up, cohesiveness against it. There is no other, in my mind, counter. And even then, it's pretty bleak. If that's what's occurring, it's going to be very difficult to escape it.
Yeah, and I think you would also be severely limited. Let's say you do live on a farm that's analog. You have food and water, but they will control all your identity and elements, the things that you would need. For example, if you wanted to drive your car, away from your farm to go visit friends and family, again, they can just shut your driver's license, your car registration, all the vehicle emissions tests. They could basically make you wouldn't be able to drive your car. They're throwing up cameras, everything everywhere, and so they would take away that mobility, planes, trains, work. And so I think if you want to get married, all this sort of stuff. So even if you are living analog, as you mentioned, it would still you'd barely be surviving because they wouldn't then allow you to participate basically in society. And you mentioned this nano warfare. If you could tell us a bit more about,
That's what I was thinking about as you were saying that. Is okay. So imagine, and I do believe that smart dust already exists. Nanotech has been, like that paper was published in 2002, but nanotech's been around for decades, and you don't hear about it, like nano manufacturing. You don't hear much about all that. Well, where's it all at? It's definitely happening. Most of the World Economic Forum goals are tied up into nanotech. I think the majority of those goals have something to do with it. So somebody's doing it. Well, smart dust exists. Nano mRNA, nanoparticle, nano manipulation is cellular machinery. It's atom size machinery that's built. It's robots, okay, but it's tiny robots. If you think, I always use the example of an Amish family. They're totally off the grid. They're out plowing the fields with horses. They go to town in a horse. But if I spray nano dust on them and they get infected, and that builds an antenna system and a communication system inside their body, I now have access to them as a human. They didn't escape. They're not outside that matrix. So a lot of this, and that's why I think going back to NBIC and saying, you don't have a right to merge my biology with your nanotechnology. Who gave permission space for that to occur? If that's occurring without my permission, then I'm in a war. Okay. I have been attacked. I've been attacked by small particles that I don't know that most people would not know they've been attacked by. Right. There's machinery invading me. So, we're already, in my opinion, in a war, a cellular war. In some aspects of our society. I won't say everyone's all involved in that. I don't know. But I do know that there is an element of our society that has dealt with nanotech, smart dust, cellular manipulation. And those kind of things can be literally as devastating as a gunshot or a bomb. People run out and get guns to get ready for the apocalypse. When at the very time they're doing that, a nano bot has invaded their body, has set up a kill switch that can release a toxin and murder you on demand. So you're holding your gun and they kill you with a frequency. So, you know, nano warfare, I don't even think it's fifth generation warfare. I think it's beyond that, but it's happening in certain elements of our society, or has happened. How deep we are down that rabbit hole, I don't know. Is it global? Is it totally intruded everything? I don't know. A good resource is Dr. Anna Malcia. Let me see.
Mihalcha. Yeah, I've interviewed her on my radio program. Yeah.
Yeah, she's a very good resource for that. She does microscopy. I can't pronounce it. Dark field where you light the cells from the sides, and she shows the machinery inside people's blood. So, yeah, it's occurring. It's already happening. Who's doing it? I don't know. There's different theories on how it's getting there. I don't know. I know it's there in some people. You can confirm it looking at people's blood. And that's warfare. Who's engaging in it? I don't know. But we're already kind of down that rabbit hole.
Yeah, that makes me think again of, quote, the pandemic where, go from here on out, it seems like any future that we're sold pandemic would maybe have the appearance of a traditional form of so-called pandemic, but would in fact be this sort of nanotechnology pandemic, you know, with these new types of weapons that would mimic, you know, the disease, but it would be basically this new, it's like the technology, the disease. I don't even know what to call it. So, you know,
a good example. I mean, they can literally put a vaccination in lettuce. You know, they're working on doing things like that. I mean, what is a vaccination? Well, it's in that sense, a genetic manipulation. And again, you know, did I give permission? No, I didn't give permission for you to put machinery in my body. So there's already an untrusted element. If there is an invasion at a cellular level and you didn't give permission, somebody's invaded you, invaded your space and done something that you might agree with, but you might not, right? Some people agree with it. Some people want it. But if you don't agree with it, then it's been done against your will, which to me is warfare. So, you know, that can look like growing lettuce. That can be in animals. That can be in the meat that you eat. That could be, you can introduce that any number of ways. So, you know, what you have to, you know, you have to figure out how you're going to counter it. If you disagree with it, there are ways to counter it, but it absolutely is going on. You know, how pervasive it is, I don't know, but it absolutely is going on.
All right. We've covered a lot, Bruce. You know, any other thought or final thoughts for us?
No, I think we've kind of run the gamut on it. I would just say it's closer than you think. Artificial reasoning's around the corner. This thing can move really quickly. And what's really important, again, is trust, building local networks, local high trust networks where you absolutely trust each other is critical. And that takes work. You know, there's falling out. There's you fall out. You come back. You can't exclude anybody. You can't say you're not nobody. This kind of person's not welcome. It has to be open. But it has to be based on trust. And that's what I do to really, that's my view of preparing us for this future, regardless of who runs it, how it's run, that's going to be paramount. So, you know, everything I do revolves around trust. And I hope that people can take that to their local communities and start to build these trust networks themselves.
And that's, you know, that's often been the solution mentioned on the podcast is, you know, Teddy Roosevelt, who says, do what you can with what you got where you're at. And it's the social around you. That's the key factor, the number one to start with in terms of survival. If you look at all of history under totalitarian regimes, it's always been friends, neighbors, family, church, you know, faith, your faith group, whichever faith that is, I suppose, and so forth. Do you have any website? I know you said you don't do socials apart from LinkedIn. Any
website? Yeah, I don't at the moment. When we start setting up this institute, I'm going to have several websites associated with that. But if people want to contact me, they can reach me through LinkedIn. That's the only social site I use. Just look Bruce LaDuke up on LaDuke on LinkedIn. You can reach me there, or you can alternatively, you can send me an email at bruceleduc@gmail.com. I'm fine if you send email directly to me.
All right, Bruce, thank you for being on Geopolitics and Empire.
I appreciate it. It's been fun.
I hope you enjoyed this Geopolitics and Empire podcast. The website is geopoliticsandempire.com, and I encourage you to sign up for the free email list that goes out with each podcast and every weekend with a collection of news headlines. The newsletter and website are our last lines of defense. We're being censored and deplatformed. It's nearly impossible to find Geopolitics and Empire on the Google search engine. We've been blacklisted. YouTube frequently takes down our videos with strikes. Facebook restricts our page. Reddit and Twitter take down posts. And after the Associated Press mentioned Geopolitics and Empire in a 2021 article co-written with NATO, our Patreon account was terminated. Vimeo also terminated our Pro account. The best free way to help Geopolitics and Empire is to leave a review on Apple Podcasts or elsewhere and subscribe to all of our media channels. You can find the video broadcast now on 5 platforms: Odyssey, Rockfin, Rumble, BitChute, and Brighteon. You can find the audio broadcast on the podcast ecosystem: SoundCloud, Apple, Spotify, and so on. My current favorite social media channels are Twitter and Telegram, but you can also find us on Gab, MeWe, Minds, Float, VK, Instagram, Facebook, and LinkedIn. Finally, Geopolitics and Empire is in dire need of funding to continue. You can leave a donation, purchase a consultation with the host, or become a member to receive additional benefits. We also produce a weekly broadcast called Dissident Thinker for members and Rockfin subscribers only. We will continue to fight the good fight, come hell or high water. Thank you for listening.